leaders to ignore obvious signs of war. He had clear and grand ambitions to end the cycle of anxiety plaguing Israelis. He knew that his big aim was to stop the endless debates and second-guessing. And his methods for breaking those larger goals into smaller pieces involved finding proximal goals that were specific, measurable, achievable, and realistic, and that occurred according to a timeline. He remade his agency in a deliberate, step-by-step manner. He did everything that psychologists like Latham and Locke have said we ought to do in order to achieve both big and small goals. Yet Zaira's craving for closure and his intolerance for revisiting questions once they were answered are among the biggest reasons why Israel failed to anticipate the attacks. Zaira is an example of how stretch and smart goals, on their own, sometimes aren't enough. In addition to having audacious ambitions and plans that are thorough, we still need, occasionally, to step outside the day-to-day and consider if we're moving toward goals that make sense. We still need to think. On October 6, 2013, the 40th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War, Eli Zaira addressed an audience of national security scholars in Tel Aviv. He was 85 years old, and his gait was a bit unsteady as he walked onto the stage. He spoke haltingly from handwritten notes. He had come to defend himself, he said. Mistakes had been made, but not just by him. Everyone had learned they needed to be more careful and less certain. They were all to blame. A former colleague in the audience began heckling him. "You are telling us fairy tales," the man shouted. "You are lying." "This is not a field court-martial," Zaira replied. The war was not his fault alone, he said. No one had been willing to stare the most terrifying possibility, a full-scale invasion, in the face. But then, in a moment of reflection, Zaira conceded that he had made an error. He had ignored the seemingly impossible. He hadn't thought through all the alternatives as deeply as he should. "I usually had a note in my pocket," he told the audience. "And on that little note it said, 'And if not?'" The note was a talisman, a reminder that the desire to get something done, to be decisive, can also be a weakness. The note was supposed to prompt him to ask bigger questions. But in the days before the Yom Kippur War, "I didn't read that little note," Zaira said. "That was my mistake." Chapter 5. Managing Others. Solving a kidnapping with lean and agile thinking and a culture of trust. Frank Jansen had just returned home from a bike ride when he heard a knock at the front door. It was a sunny Saturday morning. There were kids playing soccer a few blocks away. When Jansen looked out the window, he saw a woman holding a clipboard and two men dressed in khakis and button-down shirts. Perhaps they were conducting a survey, or they were religious missionaries. Jansen didn't know why they were on his doorstep, but he hoped it wouldn't take more than a moment to shoo them away. When he opened the door, however, the men pushed their way inside. One of them grabbed Jansen, shoved him against the wall, and then threw him to the floor. He pulled a gun from his waistband and slammed the barrel across Jansen's face. The other man pressed a stun gun against Jansen's torso and pulled the trigger, momentarily paralyzing the 63-year-old. Then they bound his hands with a plastic zip tie and carried him outside into the back seat of a silver Nissan waiting in the driveway. The two men sat on either side of Jansen while the woman sat up front next to the driver. As Jansen slowly regained control of his body, he began shoving his attackers. They pushed him to the floor and applied the stun gun again. The car backed onto the street and headed west, past the field where kids were playing soccer. One of the assailants dropped a blanket over Jansen's body. The vehicle turned onto a freeway and slipped into southbound traffic. Jansen's wife came home about an hour later and found the house empty and the front door ajar. Frank's bike was propped against the garage. Maybe he had gone for a walk. An hour later, with no sign of him, his wife grew concerned. She searched the entryway, thinking he might have left a note. On the doorstep, she saw a few drops of blood. Panicked, she walked toward the driveway and found more blood outside. She phoned her daughter, who told her to call the police. Her husband, she explained to officers, was a consultant at a firm specializing in national security. Soon her home was surrounded by police cruisers and yellow crime scene tape. Black SUVs pulled up, delivering a team of FBI agents who dusted for prints and photographed indentations in the grass. For the next 2 days, agents pored over Jansen's cell phone records and interviewed neighbors and co-workers, but found nothing to indicate what was going on. Then, 3 days after the abduction, in the middle of the night on April 7, 2014, his wife's phone buzzed. It was a series of text messages from an unfamiliar number with a New York City area code. "We have your husband," the texts read, "and he is in the trunk of a car going to California. If she contacted the police, we will send him back to you in 6 boxes, and every chance we get, we will take someone in your family to Italy and torture them and kill them. We will do a drive-by and gun down anybody in your family, and we will throw grenades in your window." The texts also referenced Jansen's daughter and a man named Kelvin Melton. Suddenly, things started making a bit more sense. Jansen's daughter, Colleen, was an assistant district attorney in nearby Wake Forest, and she had prosecuted Melton, a high-ranking gang member in the Bloods, a few years earlier. Colleen had successfully sent Melton to jail for the rest of his life on a charge of assault with a deadly weapon. A theory began to emerge. Government investigators suspected that the Bloods had kidnapped Frank Jansen to punish his daughter. This was revenge for putting one of their leaders behind bars. Within hours, the police had subpoenaed the records of the phones sending the texts looking for a link with known gang members. They could tell the messages had been transmitted from Georgia, but the device was a burner, an unregistered phone bought with cash at a Walmart. There was nothing in the cellular records or purchase receipts that told investigators who owned the phone or where it was currently located. 2 days later, another text arrived from a different number, this time with an Atlanta area code. "Here is 2 picture of you husband," it read, and included photos of Jansen tied to a chair. "If you cannot tell me where my things are at tomorrow, I will start torturing Colleen father." None of the investigators had any idea what things the kidnappers were referring to. The texts also demanded that someone bring Melton, the incarcerated gang leader, a pack of cigarettes, as well as other commands. "Jefe wants his things, and he needs to get another phone fast so we can finish our business. And if I don't get word from him very, very fast, then we have problems with his people." The police didn't know if Jefe referred to Melton or someone else, or why Melton would want cigarettes delivered to him, since he could buy them inside the Polk Correctional Institution. More texts arrived with references to unknown people. "Now he know ah playin' games," one said. "Tell him we got Frano. Tell him he better find a way to tell me where my thing's at and get my money, or we kill these people in 2 days." Investigators were confused by these mentions of Jefe and Frano, and the threats to kill multiple people, even though authorities were aware of only one kidnapping victim. If this was a revenge plot, why were the kidnappers sending so many ambiguous messages? Why hadn't they made any ransom demands? One federal agent thought the kidnappers were acting as if they weren't sure what was going on themselves, as if they didn't have a plan. The FBI asked Google to look for searches around the time of the abduction that had included Jansen's address. The computer giant reported that someone using a disposable T-Mobile phone had Googled Colleen Jansen address, but what had come up was her parents' home, where she had once lived. A new theory emerged. The kidnappers had intended to kidnap Colleen as revenge for prosecuting Kevin Melton, but had accidentally grabbed her father. Investigators determined that the Georgia phone sending the latest text was also a burner, but this time, when agents approached cellular companies, their records proved more fruitful. The texts had been sent from Atlanta. Moreover, the phone had recently received a call from another number, which had been sending and receiving texts with yet another phone that police were able to determine was located inside the walls of Polk Correctional itself. That phone had placed almost 100 calls to Melton's daughters. The kidnapping, investigators came to believe, was being directed by Melton himself. The FBI phoned Polk Correctional and told the warden to search Melton's cell. When Melton saw guards approaching, he barricaded the door and smashed his phone to pieces. It would take days to recover data from the device. There was nothing the FBI could do to force Melton to cooperate with the investigators. He was already in prison for life. There was no additional information to be gleaned from any cell phone records. Agents had looked at surveillance tapes from the stores where the burner phones had been purchased and had scrutinized footage from cameras overlooking roads near Jansen's house. None of it was helpful. The FBI had hundreds of pieces of information. There were numerous dots, but nothing to connect them. Some agents hoped the FBI's new computer system, a piece of complex software named Sentinel, might help unearth connections they had overlooked. Others were more skeptical. More than a decade earlier, the Bureau had started building technologies that officials had promised would provide powerful new tools for solving crimes. Most of those efforts, however, were failures. One notable effort was abandoned in 2005 after $170 million was spent creating a search engine that crashed constantly. Another attempt was suspended in 2010 after auditors concluded it would cost millions more simply to figure out why the system wasn't working. A few years before Jansen was kidnapped, the agency's databases were still so outdated that most agents didn't even bother inputting the bulk of the information they collected during investigations. Instead, they used paper files and index cards, like their predecessors decades before. Then, in 2012, the Bureau had rolled out Sentinel. Simply put, it was a system for sorting and managing evidence, clues, witness testimony, and the tens of thousands of other little pieces of information agents collected every day. Sentinel was tied into analytical engines and databases that the Bureau and other law enforcement agencies had developed to look for patterns. The software's development had been overseen by a young man from Wall Street who had convinced the FBI to hire him by arguing that the Bureau needed to draw on lessons from companies such as Toyota and methods such as lean manufacturing and agile programming. He had promised he could get Sentinel working in less than 2 years with a handful of software engineers. And then he had delivered. Now Sentinel was functional. No one working on the Jansen case was certain if it would provide any help, but they were desperate. One of the agents began inputting each piece of information they had collected thus far, and then sat back to see if Sentinel would spit anything useful out. 2. When Rick Madrid showed up for his job interview at the old General Motors plant, he wore mirrored shades, an Iron Maiden t-shirt, and a pair of cut-off jeans he had once described as the greatest aphrodisiac in Northern California. It was 1984. Out of courtesy toward his interviewers, and because Madrid wanted this job, he had combed his beard and put on deodorant. He drew the line, however, at wearing sleeves that covered his tattoos. Madrid was familiar with the plant in Fremont, California, because he had worked there until 2 years earlier, when GM had shut it down. Fremont was known, locally and nationally, as the worst auto factory in the world. 8 hours a day for 27 years, Madrid had pounded rims into place with a sledgehammer, proselytized about the greatness of the United Auto Workers, and served rounds of magic screwdrivers, a high-octane mixture of vodka and orange juice that he poured into plastic cups wedged into car frames so co-workers could partake as the vehicles progressed down the line. Fremont's assembly conveyors always moved smoothly, so the drinks hardly ever spilled. The bags of ice he put in the vehicle's trunks often warped the liners, but that was the problem of whoever bought the car. "Work was an interruption in my leisure time," Madrid later said. "I was there to earn money. I really didn't care about the quality of the job, and neither did GM. They just wanted to get as many cars out as they could." When Madrid showed up for this interview, however, he suspected things might be different this time. GM was partnering with the Japanese automaker Toyota to reopen the Fremont plant. For Toyota, this was a chance to build cars inside the United States and expand the company's sales in America. For General Motors, it was an opportunity to learn about the famed Toyota Production System, which was producing cars of very high quality at very low costs in Japan. One hitch in the partnership was that GM's agreement with the UAW dictated that the plant had to hire at least 80% of its workers from employees who had been laid off 2 years earlier. So Madrid and his friends were showing up, one by one, to interview with New United Motor Manufacturing Inc., or NUMMI. Madrid figured he was a good candidate, because his on-the-job drinking, truth be told, was tame compared to the antics of his former colleagues. Yes, he may have gotten drunk and had sex in the warehouse where they stored Chevy seats, but unlike many of his co-workers, he didn't snort coke while attaching brake pads or smoke weed from bongs built from muffler parts. He hadn't been a patron of the parking lot RV where prostitutes offered services perfectly timed to union-mandated work breaks. Nor had Madrid ever deliberately sabotaged a vehicle like those who put empty whiskey bottles and loose screws behind door panels so they would bang around after the cars were sold. The saboteurs were an extreme example of a fierce war that had consumed the Fremont plant in the GM days. Workers weren't above dirty tactics if they thought it would strengthen their union's hand. Employees knew that as long as they kept the assembly line moving, no one was likely to get punished for misbehavior, no matter how egregious. At GM, all that really mattered was keeping production on pace. Employees sometimes discovered mistakes on cars as they moved along the conveyor belt, but rather than stop and fix the problems, they would mark the vehicle with a wax crayon or a post-it note and let it continue on its way. Eventually, those fully assembled autos would be hauled into the back lot and taken apart to repair the error. Once, a worker had a heart attack and fell into the pit as a car passed over. Everyone waited for the vehicle to rumble along before they pulled him out. They all knew the plant's fundamental law: the line doesn't stop. Madrid's first interview occurred in a small conference room. Across the table was a representative from the UAW, two Toyota executives from Japan, and a GM manager. Everyone exchanged pleasantries. They asked Madrid about his background and gave him some basic math and assembly problems to test his knowledge of auto manufacturing. They asked if he intended to drink while working. "No," he said, "he was done with that." It was a relatively brief conversation. Then, as he was walking out, one of the men from Japan asked Madrid what he had disliked about the plant when he worked there last time. Rick Madrid had never been shy about speaking his mind. He didn't like working on cars he knew had problems, he told them, because whatever he was doing would have to be undone to repair a mistake. He didn't like that his suggestions were always ignored by his superiors. Once, he said, when a new tire mounting machine was being installed, he had come up with an idea for putting the controls in a different place to speed up work. He even sought out an engineer to show him a diagram of the concept. But when he came back from lunch, the new machine was in place with the controls in their original location. I operated from the left side of the tire machine. All the controls were on the right side, he told the interviewers. Thank goodness that engineer didn't build bridges. When the plant was run by GM, workers were just cogs in a machine, Madrid told them. You were just there to do what they told you to do, he said. Nobody ever asked him his opinion or cared what he thought. He expressed all these frustrations to his interviewers and then kicked himself on the long drive home. He really needed this job. He should have kept his mouth shut. A few days later, Madrid got the call. The Japanese executives had appreciated his honesty and were offering him a job. First, though, he would have to go to Japan for 2 weeks and learn about the Toyota production system. 16 days later, Numi flew Madrid and about 24 other workers to the Takaoka auto plant outside Toyota City, Japan, the first in a series of trips nearly every employee at Numi would take. When Madrid walked into the Japanese factory, he saw familiar assembly lines and heard the recognizable sounds of pneumatic tools hissing and buzzing. Why had they bothered flying him across the world to train inside a factory just like the one at home? After a basic tour and an orientation meeting, Madrid walked onto the factory floor and watched one man put bolts into door frames over and over with an air-powered gun. By the time each car rolled off the line, Madrid knew, those bolts would be buried under layers of metal and plastic. It was just like California, except the signs were in Japanese and the bathrooms were much cleaner. Then, the worker manning the pneumatic gun pushed a bolt into place, applied his tool, and an ugly squeal sounded. The bolt had misthread the hole, a common mistake, and was stuck halfway in the door frame. Madrid expected the man to signal the defect by marking the door, like they did at GM, so the car could be eventually towed to a back lot and repaired. The problem with that system, however, was that replacing the bolt would require disassembling the door, repairing the mistake, and then rebuilding everything. The trim would be less snug in the vehicle's frame afterward. Whoever bought the car wouldn't notice at first, but after a few years, the door would start jiggling. It would be a shoddier vehicle. When the screw gun squealed inside the Japanese plant, though, something unexpected happened. The worker who made the mistake reached above his head and pulled a hanging cable that turned on a spinning yellow light. He then reversed the direction of his screw gun and pulled the bolt out of the door frame, grabbed another tool, and used it to smooth the hole's threads. At this point, a manager walked over, stood behind the worker, and began asking questions. The worker ignored his boss except to bark out a few orders, and then grabbed another tool to rethread the hole. The conveyor belt was still moving, but the worker hadn't finished his repair. When the door got to the end of the worker's station, the entire assembly line stopped. Madrid had no idea what was going on. Another man, clearly a senior manager, came over. Instead of yelling, he laid out a new bolt and equipment on a tray, like a nurse in an operating room. The worker kept issuing orders to his superiors. In Fremont, that would have gotten him slugged. Here, though, there were no angry shouts or anxious whispers. The other men on the line were calmly standing in place or double-checking parts they had just installed. No one seemed surprised at what was happening. Then the worker completed his rethreading, put a new bolt in the door, and pulled the cord above his head again. The assembly line started moving at normal speed. Everyone went back to work. I just didn't believe it, Madrid said. Back home, I had seen a guy fall in the pit, and they didn't stop the line. for so many years, I had learned you don't stop the line no matter what. He had been told it cost $15,000 a minute to pause an assembly line. But for Toyota, quality came before income. That's when it dawned on me that we can do this. We can compete against these guys by learning what they do, Madrid said. One bolt changed my attitude. I felt that I could finally take pride in what I do. As Madrid continued his training in Japan, there were other surprises as well. One day he shadowed a worker who, midway through a shift, told the manager he had an idea for a new tool that would help him install struts. The manager walked to the machine shop and returned 15 minutes later with a prototype. The worker and manager refined the design throughout the day. The next morning, everyone had their own versions of the tool waiting at their stations. Madrid's trainers explained that the Toyota production system, which in the United States would become known as lean manufacturing, relied on pushing decision-making to the lowest possible level. Workers on the assembly line were the ones who saw problems first. They were closest to the glitches that were inevitable in any manufacturing process. So it only made sense to give them the greatest authority in finding solutions. Every person in an organization has the right to be the company's top expert at something, John Shook, who trained Madrid as one of Toyota's first Western employees, told me. If I'm attaching mufflers, or I'm a receptionist, or a janitor, I know more about exhaust systems, or receiving people, or cleaning offices, than anyone else. And it's incredibly wasteful if a company can't take advantage of that knowledge. Toyota hates waste. The system was built to exploit everyone's expertise. When Toyota had first proposed this management philosophy to General Motors, the Americans literally laughed at their naivete. Maybe that approach works in Japan, they said, but it would fail in California. Workers at the Fremont plant didn't care about contributing expertise. What they cared about was doing as little work as possible. But the only way we would agree to the partnership was if GM promised to give this a try, said Shook. Our basic philosophy was that no one goes to work wanting to suck. If you put people in a position to succeed, they will. What we didn't say was that if we couldn't figure out how to export the Toyota production system, we were screwed, Shook said. It's the culture that makes Toyota successful, not hanging cords or prototyping tools. If we couldn't export a culture of trust, we had no other ideas. So we sent everyone to America and prayed it would work. In 1994, two business school professors at Stanford began studying how, exactly, one creates an atmosphere of trust within a company. For years, the professors, James Barron and Michael Hannon, had been teaching students that a firm's culture mattered as much as its strategy. The way a business treats workers, they said, was critical to its success. In particular, they argued that within most companies, no matter how great the product or loyal the customers, things would eventually fall apart unless employees trusted one another. Then, each year, a few students would ask for evidence that supported those claims. The truth was, Barron and Hannon believed their assertions were true, but they didn't have much data to back them up. Both men were trained as sociologists and could point to studies showing the importance of culture in making employees happy or recruiting new workers or encouraging a healthy work-life balance. But there were few papers showing how a company's culture impacted profitability. So in 1994, they embarked on a multi-year project to see if they could prove their assertion right. First, though, they needed to find an industry that had lots of new companies they could track over time. It occurred to them that the flurry of technology startups appearing in Silicon Valley might provide the perfect sample. At the time, the Internet was in its infancy, Most Americans thought the at sign was something to ignore on a keyboard. Google was still just a number spelled G-O-O-G-O-L. We weren't inherently interested in tech, and we had no idea the companies we were studying would become big deals, said Barron, who now teaches at Yale. We just needed startups to study. And there were tech companies getting founded nearby. And so every morning, we would buy the San Jose Mercury News and go through each page. And whenever a young company was mentioned, we would put our team into pursuit to find a phone number or mailing address, and then send someone to see if the CEO would answer a questionnaire. Over time, as they put it in a study they later wrote, without realizing it when we started our study in 1994 to 1995, we assembled the most comprehensive database to date on the histories, structures, and HR practices of high-tech companies in Silicon Valley, just as the region was about to witness an economic and technological boom of historic proportions. The project ended up taking 15 years and examining close to 200 firms. Their surveys looked at almost every variable that might influence a startup's culture, including how employees were recruited, how applicants were interviewed, how much people were paid, and which workers executives decided to promote or fire. They watched college dropouts become billionaires, and in other cases, high-flying executives crash and burn. Eventually, they collected enough data to conclude that most companies had cultures that fell into one of five categories. One was a culture they referred to as the STAR model. At these firms, executives hired from elite universities or other successful companies and gave employees huge amounts of autonomy. Offices had fancy cafeterias and lavish perks. Venture capitalists love STAR model companies because giving money to the A-team, conventional wisdom held, was always the safest bet. The second category was the engineering model. Inside firms with engineering cultures, there weren't many individual stars, but engineers, as a group, held the most sway. An engineering mindset prevailed in solving problems or approaching hiring decisions. This is your stereotypical Silicon Valley startup, with a bunch of anonymous programmers drinking Mountain Dew at their computers, said Barron. They're young and hungry, and might be the next generation of stars once they prove themselves. But right now, they're focused on solving technical problems. Engineering-focused cultures are powerful because they allow firms to grow quickly. Think of how fast Facebook expanded, said Barron. When everyone comes from a similar background and mindset, you can rely on common social norms to keep everyone on the same path. The third and fourth categories of companies included those firms built around bureaucracies and those constructed as autocracies. In the bureaucratic model, cultures emerged through thick ranks of middle managers. Executives wrote extensive job descriptions, organizational charts, and employee handbooks. Everything was spelled out, and there were rituals, such as weekly all-hands meetings, that regularly communicated the firm's values to its workers. An autocratic culture is similar, except that all the rules, job descriptions, and organizational charts ultimately point to the desires and goals of one person, usually the founder or CEO. One autocratic chief executive told us that his cultural model was, "You work, you do what I say, you get paid," Barron said. The final category was known as the commitment model, and it was a throwback to an age when people happily worked for one company their entire life. Commitment CEOs say things like, "I want to build the kind of company where people only leave when they retire or die," said Barron. That doesn't necessarily mean the company is stodgy, but it does imply a set of values that might prioritize slow and steady growth. Some Silicon Valley executives told Barron they saw commitment firms as outdated, remnants of a corporate paternalism that had undermined industries such as American manufacturing. commitment companies were more hesitant to lay people off. They often hired HR professionals when other startups were using precious dollars to recruit engineers or salespeople. Commitment CEOs believe that getting the culture right is more important at first than designing the best product, Barron said. Over the next decade, Barron and Hannon kept close tabs on which startups thrived and which ones stumbled. About half the firms they studied remained in business for at least a decade. Some became the most successful companies in the world. Barron and Hannon's goal was to see if particular corporate cultures were more likely to correlate with success. They were unprepared, however, for how dramatically the impact of culture came through. Even in the fast-paced world of high-tech entrepreneurship in Silicon Valley, founders' employment models exert powerful and enduring effects on how their companies evolve and perform, the researchers wrote in 2002 in the journal California Management Review. The enormous impact of cultural decisions is evident even after taking account of numerous other factors that might be expected to affect the success or failure of young technology ventures, such as company age, size, access to venture capital, changes in senior leadership, and the economic environment. Just as Barron and Hannon had suspected, the STAR model produced some of the study's biggest winners. As it turned out, putting all the smartest people in the same room could yield vast influence and wealth. But, unexpectedly, STAR firms also failed in record numbers. As a group, they were less likely to make it to an IPO than any other category, and they were often beset by internal rivalries. As anyone who has ever worked in such a company knows, infighting is often more vicious inside a STAR-focused firm because everyone wants to be the STAR. In fact, when Barron and Hannon looked at their data, they found the only culture that was a consistent winner were the commitment firms. Hands down, a commitment culture outperformed every other type of management style in almost every meaningful way. Not one of the commitment firms we studied failed, said Barron. None of them, which is amazing in its own right. But they were also the fastest companies to go public, had the highest profitability ratios, and tended to be leaner with fewer middle managers, because when you choose employees slowly, you have time to find people who excel at self-direction. Employees in commitment firms wasted less time on internal rivalries because everyone was committed to the company rather than to personal agendas. Commitment companies tended to know their customers better than other kinds of firms, and as a result, could detect shifts in the market faster. Despite its being widely pronounced dead in Silicon Valley in the mid-1990s, the commitment model fares very well in our sample, the researchers wrote. Venture capitalists love STAR firms because when you're investing in a portfolio of companies, all you need are a few huge successes, Barron told me. But if you're an entrepreneur and you're betting on just one company, then the data says you're much better off with a commitment-focused culture. One of the reasons commitment cultures were successful, it seemed, was because a sense of trust emerged among workers, managers, and customers that enticed everyone to work harder and stick together through the setbacks that are inevitable in any industry. Most commitment companies avoided layoffs unless there was no other alternative. They invested heavily in training. There were higher levels of teamwork and psychological safety. Commitment companies might not have had lavish cafeterias, but they offered generous maternity leaves, daycare programs, and work-from-home options. These initiatives were not immediately cost-effective, but commitment firms valued making employees happy over quick profits. And as a result, workers tended to turn down higher-paying jobs at rival firms. And customers stayed loyal because they had relationships that stretched over years. Commitment firms dodged one of the business world's biggest hidden costs. The profits that are lost when an employee takes clients or insights to a competitor. Good employees are always the hardest asset to find, said Barron. When everyone wants to stick around, you've got a pretty strong advantage. The first thing Rick Madrid did upon returning to California was tell everyone what he had seen in Japan. He talked about the hanging cables, called andon cords, and about how managers took commands from workers instead of the other way around. He described watching assembly lines stop because some mechanic decided he needed more time to rebolt the door. He declared that everything at the Fremont plant was about to change now that Numi was in charge. His friends were skeptical. They had heard this story before. GM had often said the company valued employee input, until employees began recommending changes that management didn't want to hear. In the weeks before the Numi plant opened, the factory's workers made sure their union memberships were up to date and held meetings to discuss tactics for fighting management if it came to that. They voted to create a Numi work stoppage fund to pay for workers' expenses if they went on strike. They demanded, and Numi immediately agreed to provide, a formal system for filing grievances. Then Numi's management announced the company's layoff policy. New United Motor Manufacturing, Inc. recognizes that job security is essential to an employee's well-being, read the company's agreement with United Auto Workers. The company agrees that it will not lay off employees unless compelled to do so by severe economic conditions that threaten the long-term viability of the company. Numi promised it would cut executive pay rather than fire workers and train people to sweep floors, repair machines, or serve meals in the cafeteria to preserve their jobs. Every employee complaint and suggestion, no matter how far-fetched or expensive, would be implemented, or a response would be publicly posted explaining why not. Every team was given authority to change their station's layouts and workflow. Anyone, at any time, could stop the assembly line if they saw a problem. No American car company had ever made so public a promise to avoid layoffs and respond to worker complaints. Skeptical workers said that such pledges were easy to make when the plant wasn't even operating yet, but they grudgingly agreed to play along. The factory began producing Chevy Novas on December 10, 1984. Rick Madrid was assigned to a team that stamped out hoods and doors from giant sheets of steel. It was immediately clear to him that things were different. People who once sought trysts in the storage room kept their hands to themselves. There was no obvious drinking on the job. The RV hadn't returned to the parking lot. People were scared to try anything. They didn't want to push their luck. This hesitancy, however, also had less useful consequences. No one was pulling andon cords or making suggestions because no one was eager to cost the factory $15,000 a minute. No one was sure it wouldn't cost them their job. A month after the plant reopened, Tetsuro Toyoda, Numi's president, whose grandfather had founded Toyota in 1933, walked the Fremont floor. He saw an employee struggling to install a taillight that was wedged into a car frame at an odd angle. Toyoda approached the worker and, reading the name stitched on his uniform, said, "Joe, please pull the cord." "I can fix this, sir," Joe said. "Joe, please pull the cord." Joe had never pulled an andon cord. No one in his area had. Since the plant had opened, there had been only a few cord pulls, and one of those had been an accident. "Sir, I can fix this," Joe said, working furiously to pop the taillight into place. Joe's team leader was standing nearby. That man's manager had been shadowing Toyoda as he walked through the factory, so he was orbiting nearby as well. When Joe glanced up, he saw a half dozen of the plant's most senior executives staring back. "Joe, please, Toyoda said. Then he stepped over, took Joe's hand in his own, and guided it to the ondon cord, and together they pulled. A flashing light began spinning. When the chassis reached the end of Joe's station without the taillight correctly in place, the line stopped moving. Joe was shaking so much, he had to hold his crowbar with both hands. He finally got the taillight positioned, and, with a terrified glance at his bosses, reached up and pulled the ondon cord, restarting the line. Toyoda faced Joe and bowed. He began speaking in Japanese. Joe, please forgive me, a lieutenant translated. I have done a poor job of instructing your managers of the importance of helping you pull the cord when there is a problem. You are the most important part of this plant. Only you can make every car great. I promise I will do everything in my power to never fail you again. By lunchtime, everyone inside the factory had heard the story. The next day, ondon cords were pulled more than a dozen times. The next week, more than two dozen times. A month later, the plant was averaging nearly 100 pulls a day. The importance of the ondon cords and the employee suggestions and Toyoda's apology was that they demonstrated that the fate of the company was in the employees' hands. There was a genuine devotion to convincing employees they were part of a family, said Joel Smith, the UAW representative at NUMMI. It had to be reinforced constantly, but it was real. We might have disagreements or see things differently, but at the end of the day, we were committed to each other's success. If people started pulling ondons for no good reason, the plant would have fallen apart, said Smith. Everyone knew it still cost thousands of dollars each minute a line was stopped, and that anyone could stop the line at any time without penalty. So employees could bankrupt the place if they wanted to. Once you're entrusted with that kind of authority, you can't help feel a sense of responsibility, said Smith. The most junior workers didn't want NUMMI to go bankrupt, and the management didn't want that. And so, suddenly, everyone was on the same side of the table. And as workers were empowered to make more choices, their motivation skyrocketed. Just as Mauricio Delgado and the U.S. Marine Corps had found in other settings, when workers felt a greater sense of control, their drive expanded. Word of the NUMMI experiment spread quickly. When professors from Harvard Business School visited a few years after the plant reopened, they found that former GM employees who once spent only 45 seconds of every minute working now averaged 57 seconds of labor per minute. By 1986, NUMMI's productivity was higher than that of any other GM facility and more than twice that of its predecessor, GM Fremont, they wrote. Absenteeism had dropped from 25% during the GM days to 3% under NUMMI. There were no observable levels of substance abuse, prostitution, or sabotage. The formal grievance system was hardly ever used. NUMMI's productivity was as high as that of plants in Japan, even though its workers were, on average, 10 years older and much less experienced with the Toyota production system, the Harvard researchers wrote. In 1985, Car and Driver magazine printed an issue with the cover line, "Hell Freezes Over," announcing NUMMI's accomplishments. The worst auto factory on Earth had become one of the most productive plants in existence, using the same workers as before. Then, 4 years after NUMMI opened, the recession hit the auto industry. The stock market crashed. Unemployment was rising. Car sales plummeted. NUMMI's managers estimated they needed to reduce production by 40%. Everyone was saying there were going to be layoffs, said Smith, the UAW rep. Instead, the plant's top 65 executives all took pay cuts. Assembly line workers were reassigned to janitorial duties or landscaping, or sent into the paint room to scrape air vents instead of let go. The company proved it was committed. After that, workers were willing to do anything for the company, Smith said. Four separate sales slumps over 30 years, and Noumi never did layoffs once. And each time, when the business finally came back, everyone worked harder than before. Rick Madrid retired from Noumi in 1992, after almost four decades of building cars. 3 years later, the Smithsonian mounted an exhibit at the National Museum of American History that included Madrid's ID badge and his hat in a show named A Palace of Progress. Noumi, the curators wrote, was iconic, a factory that had demonstrated it was possible to unite workers and managers around a common cause through mutual commitment and shared power. Even now, Noumi is cited inside business schools and by corporate chieftains as an example of what organizations can achieve when a commitment culture takes hold. Since Noumi was founded, the lean manufacturing principles have infiltrated nearly every corner of American commerce, from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to healthcare. I'm really glad I ended up my years as an auto worker at Noumi, Madrid said. I went from being depressed, bored, people didn't even know I existed, to seeing J.D. Power name Noumi as a top-quality plant. Noumi's workers got together for a party after that J.D. Power announcement. And when I spoke, I said, "We're the best damn auto workers in the world," said Madrid. "Not just the workers, not just the managers. All of us together are the best, because we're devoted to each other." 3. 6 years before Frank Jansen was kidnapped, the Federal Bureau of Investigation had reached out to a 34-year-old Wall Street executive to see if he would be interested in overseeing development of the Bureau's technology systems. Chad Fulghum had never worked in law enforcement before. His specialty was developing large computer networks for investment banks such as Lehman Brothers and J.P. Morgan Chase. So he was surprised when he received a call in 2008 explaining that the FBI wanted an interview. Improving the Bureau's technology had long been a priority for federal officials. As early as 1997, the FBI's top leaders had promised Congress they would deliver an overhauled system that tied together the dozens of internal databases and analytical engines the Bureau maintained. This network, officials said, would give agents powerful new tools for connecting the dots among disparate cases. But by the time the Bureau contacted Fulghum 11 years later, work on that system, Sentinel, had already consumed $305 million, with no end in sight. The agency had brought in an outside group to figure out why Sentinel was taking so long. The experts said the Bureau was so bogged down by bureaucracy and conflicting agendas that it would take tens of millions of dollars simply to get the program back on track. The Bureau called Fulghum to see if he could find a cheaper way to get things moving again. "I secretly always wanted to work for the FBI or the CIA," he told me. "So when they called me, particularly with this huge, hairy problem, it was like getting offered my dream job." First, though, Fulghum needed to convince the Bureau that his approach was the right one. Fulghum's management style, he explained, drew its inspiration from examples like Noumi. In the previous two decades, as Noumi's success had become better known, executives in other industries had started adapting the Toyota production system philosophy to other industries. In 2001, a group of computer programmers had gathered at a ski lodge in Utah to write a set of principles called the Manifesto for Agile Software Development, that adapted Toyota's methods and lean manufacturing to how software was created. The Agile methodology, as it came to be known, emphasized collaboration, frequent testing, rapid iteration, and pushing decision-making to whoever was closest to a problem. It quickly revolutionized software development, and now is the standard methodology among many tech firms. Among filmmakers, the Pixar method was modeled specifically on Toyota's management techniques and became famous for empowering low-level animators to make critical choices. When Pixar's leadership was asked to take over Disney Animation in 2008, executives introduced themselves with what became known as the Toyota speech, in which I described the car company's commitment to empowering its employees and letting people on the assembly line make decisions when they encountered problems, Pixar co-founder Ed Catmull later wrote. I stressed that no one at Disney needed to wait for permission to come up with solutions. What is the point of hiring smart people, we asked, if you don't empower them to fix what's broken? In hospitals, the distribution of authority to nurses and others who are not physicians is referred to as lean healthcare. It is a management philosophy and a culture in which anyone can, and indeed must, stop the line or stop the care process if they feel something is not right, the chairman of one lean hospital, the Virginia Mason Medical Center, wrote in 2005. These approaches emerged in different industries, but they and other adaptations of lean manufacturing shared key attributes. Each was dedicated to devolving decision-making to the person closest to a problem. They all encouraged collaboration by allowing teams to self-manage and self-organize. They emphatically insisted on a culture of commitment and trust. Fulghum argued that the FBI's technology efforts could succeed only if the Bureau embraced a similar approach. FBI officials had to commit to distributing critical decision-making power to people on the ground, he said, such as lowly software engineers or junior field agents. This approach was a significant shift because previously, Bureau executives, distrustful of one another and consumed by internal power struggles, had designed new technology systems by first outlining thousands of specifications each piece of software needed to satisfy. Committees filled hundreds of pages with rules for how databases ought to function. Any major change required approvals from numerous officials. The system was so dysfunctional that software development teams would sometimes spend months building a program, only to be told it was canceled when they were done. And the results were often dysfunctional as well. When Fulghum asked for a demonstration of the Sentinel work done thus far, for instance, an engineer led him to a computer monitor and invited him to input some keywords, such as a criminal's alias and an address associated with a crime. In 15 minutes, we'll have a report of previous cases linked to that address and name, the engineer said. The people I'm going to report to carry guns, and you want me to tell them it will take the computer 15 minutes to provide help? Said Fulghum. A 2010 Inspector General's report had said it would take another 6 years and $396 million to get Sentinel working. Fulghum told the Bureau's director that if they gave him the authority to distribute control, he would cut the number of people needed from more than 400 to just 30 employees and deliver Sentinel for $20 million in a bit over a year. Soon, Fulghum and a team of software engineers and FBI agents were holed up in the basement of the Bureau's Washington, D.C. headquarters. The only rules, Fulghum told them, were that everyone had to make suggestions. Anyone could declare a timeout if they thought a project was moving in the wrong direction, and the person closest to a problem had primary responsibility for figuring out how to solve it. The main problem with Sentinel, Fulghum believed, was that the Bureau, like many big organizations, had tried to plan everything in advance. But creating great software requires flexibility. Problems pop up unexpectedly, and breakthroughs are unpredictable. The truth was, no one knew exactly how FBI agents would use Sentinel once it was functional, or how it would need to change as crime-fighting techniques evolved. So instead of meticulously pre-designing each interface and system, instead of trying to control from above, they needed to make Sentinel into a tool that could adapt to agents' needs. And the only way to do that, Fulghum was convinced, was if developers were unfettered themselves. Fulghum's team started by coming up with more than 1,000 scenarios in which Sentinel could be useful.